back to Evidence-Based Dermatology Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Putman. This is episode 109. Abatacept inhibits inflammation and onset of rheumatoid arthritis in individuals at high risk. Randomized international multi-center double-blind placebo-controlled trial, also known as ARIA. Now, this was published in Lancet Rheumatology, February 13th of 2024, and I'm excited to talk about it because I think it's a very interesting trial that has influenced my practice, although not necessarily in the way that I think it was ostensibly meant to do so. So let me give the background for this trial, which is that there's a lot of interest in stopping RA before it occurs. You know, once RA happens, it kind of sets up shop, and some people develop difficult to control RA, some people develop easy to control RA, but wouldn't it be nice if they didn't develop RA at all? So if you're trying to stop RA, the first question is, you know, who's at risk of developing RA? And one of the strongest risk factors that's been seen consistently across the literature is the presence of anti-citrullinated peptide antibodies, ACPAs. Consequently, there have been a number of studies that have investigated the use of some form of early intervention among patients who have ACPA positivity or some other signs of early rheumatoid arthritis. This kind of goes back to that age-old axiom that a pint of prevention is worth a pound of cure, or some pints maybe more, is it a pinch of prevention? However much prevention you want is better than a lot of cure, I guess. So they're doing the same thing here. Now, the design of this study, this was a randomized international multi-center double-blind placebo-controlled trial in 14 hospitals, so nice big study. And then this is where things get complicated. They enrolled patients who were 18 years or older who had a current or past history of joint pain, but no pain or swelling in the hand. All right, so automatically you hear that and you say, so they had joint pain, but no pain and swelling. That's certainly a group of people who may not meet criteria for rheumatoid arthritis. Maybe they're going to develop rheumatoid arthritis, but don't have it yet, I guess. All right. Then you had to be positive for ACPAs, which, okay, so another big risk factor. And here's where they lose me a little bit. They had to have evidence of subclinical synovitis, tenosynovitis, or osteitis on an MRI. And this is where I hit the brakes. I highly recommend you all subscribe to my newsletter. It's at Figure 1. I write this in concert with Anisha Dua. But so on the newsletter I said, and you know, I guess I'm kind of quoting myself here, I said, you know, I have a word for a patient who presents to me with joint pain, ACPAs, and swelling on an MRI. I call that rheumatoid arthritis. And I know that this is perhaps debatable, but for me, a patient who comes in and says, hey, I've had, you know, pain, joint pain, it's a small joint, polyarthralgia, you know, but then that I send some labs, they have positive ACPAs, and then I say, hey, you know, I don't feel any synovitis here, but I understand that you're suffering. Let's check an MRI and see if I'm missing something, or do an ultrasound to see if I'm missing something. And then I see clear synovitis, then I say, hey, you have rheumatoid arthritis, and then I treat them. So my biggest concern with this study and with all studies of this nature is that, you know, I think these patients may have just had rheumatoid arthritis, or at least they have what I would call rheumatoid arthritis. Now, they couldn't have been on glucocorticoid treatment. They couldn't have received other immunosuppressive drugs or DMARDs, which makes sense. And then they're randomized one-to-one to receive either abatacept or placebo. And this is really cool, and this is one reason I like this study. They gave the treatment drug for 6 months, kind of a short time period there, and then they followed them for 12 months off drug. And this is very useful, because for one, you know, you can see whether or not they developed any symptoms, and then for two, you can see what happens when you stop this. Are we actually preventing, or are we just signing you up to long-term treatment with a DMARD earlier than we would have otherwise? So by stopping it, they can kind of answer both questions, and I like it. Now, the primary endpoint was the proportion of participants with improved subclinical synovitis, tenosynovitis, or osteitis after 6 months. I mean, I guess, but like, what's the value of that? We're treating subclinical MRI inflammation. I mean, the only reason we would do that is if we're already calling this rheumatoid arthritis, which I would do, but I don't know if that's like a great endpoint, but they had a key secondary endpoint, which was the development of clinical arthritis, which they defined by joint swelling and essentially meeting the 2010 ACR-EULAR classification criteria for RA. Here's another red flag for me. Now, I love classification criteria. I think they're very useful for enrolling patients in clinical trials and designing good observational studies. But hey, when it comes to diagnosis, classification criteria are not what you need. And you know, for diagnosis, the goal of diagnosis is to improve patients' health, their quality of life, or their duration of life. The goal of diagnosis isn't to like classify them. And so the classification criteria, because they're designed toward doing science and not necessarily patient care, they typically are conservative. So a lot of patients who I would say have vasculitis may not meet the classification criteria for vasculitis. Similarly, a lot of people who I would say have RA aren't going to meet these RA classification criteria. And so I think part of what we're doing in studies like this is we're taking patients who, because of the artifact of how we design diagnostic and classification criteria, don't meet what we call as like clearly, obviously rheumatoid arthritis, but many, many clinicians would be happy calling them rheumatoid arthritis. And at the end of the day, the thing that matters, improving patients' quality of life, is probably going to, you know, functionally they have RA because they will probably respond to immunosuppressing therapy. Now, this was actually not that big of a study. They powered it. Their statistical power, they wound up needing 98 patients. Nothing too exciting. The key secondary outcome that I talked about was done using an event, time-to-event analysis, which I like. That was all pretty appropriate. So what did they find? Well, they ran this between 2014 and 2021. There was a female predominance. About 60 to 80% of patients were female. The age was around 50. Rheumatoid arthritis and first degree relatives was pretty high, you know, in the 30s for percentages. Everyone had ACPA positivity, but then 70% of patients were RF positive. So again, I mean, a patient comes in with me, they have joint pains, they have MRI inflammation, they're dual positive with CCPs and rheumatoid factors. I mean, I'm going to call that patient RA. And then the symptom duration, you know, you may say, are these early? These patients had, well, symptom duration was 7 or 8 months with, you know, some of these patients had symptoms for a couple of years. And so again, I mean, these are patients who've had these symptoms for quite a long time. What did they find? The primary outcome, that was the proportion of patients who had MRI improvement and signs of inflammation. Hey, it worked. At 6 months, 57% of people in the abatacept group and 31% of people in the placebo group had an improvement. The hazard ratio and confidence intervals favored the drug. So lo and behold, abatacept works for improving MRI signs of subclinical inflammation among people who are ACPA positive and have joint pain. I mean, that's totally unsurprising, right? Abatacept is a good drug for rheumatoid arthritis. We have a number of trials showing this. And so to me, this is, you know, what I would have expected. As far as what got better, so the main improvement was actually in tenosynovitis. And I thought this was interesting. I wonder if because we're trying to find these people who have subclinical inflammation without joint swelling that we can appreciate on an exam, are we selecting for people who have more tenosynovitis as opposed to synovitis? I thought that was kind of an interesting sort of sub part of the primary outcome measure, but you know, neither here nor there. Synovitis scores also decreased. Now, the main thing that I'm interested in is the development of clinical rheumatoid arthritis. So they said in 4 or 8% of participants in the abatacept group and 35% of people in the placebo group developed clinical rheumatoid arthritis. So that's a big difference, right? I highly recommend everyone hit the brakes really quick and go take a look at the Kaplan-Meier curve. It's on page 6 of the study itself, and it tells the whole story. When you look at the incidence of new onset rheumatoid arthritis in the placebo group, which is in red, you know, it shoots up. About 30-some percent of people, 35 I guess, developed rheumatoid arthritis within the first 6 months. And in the abatacept group, it really suppressed the development of rheumatoid arthritis. But remember, this isn't development of rheumatoid arthritis from the patient's perspective. All of these patients already had joint pain. All of them already had inflammation on an MRI. All of them already had the right antibody profile. This was the incidence of meeting criteria. So, you know, you give a person treatment for rheumatoid arthritis, they don't develop criteria meeting rheumatoid arthritis. I mean, again, that's not very surprising to me. And then at 6 months, they stop the drug, and it's pretty interesting. You can see the patients who got abatacept, they just kind of shoot right up. A lot of the ones who clearly didn't develop rheumatoid arthritis upfront because they're on abatacept over the first 6 months went on to develop it during the subsequent 12 months. Now, you know, if you look at the Kaplan-Meier curves and statistics, there was a delay in the progression, and there were some people. It looks like the abatacept group, you know, after 18 months, there were fewer people who wound up developing clinical rheumatoid arthritis. So in the placebo group, it kind of trended upwards over time to 57% of patients. And in the abatacept group, it was only 35% of patients who ultimately developed rheumatoid arthritis. So that would kind of lead you to wonder if maybe we're changing some underlying immunophenotype. Yeah, I guess. I also wonder if, you know, if we follow the abatacept group for another 6 to 12 months, if they would have gotten to the same point, right? Are we just shifting this curve backward by 6 months, and that's why this looks that way? If you kind of look at the curves, it kind of feels like that might be what's happening. And given a longer time of follow-up, I imagine they would have trended to about the same place. But I think it's debatable whether or not giving this abatacept is fundamentally changing the underlying immunophenotype of these patients. I could buy that, but I don't think that's what's happening. My guess is that we're just delaying it. So those are the main results. There's a number of secondary endpoints that were all met. I mean, at the end of the day, treating rheumatoid arthritis with abatacept is successful, right? HAC-DI scores were better, DAS28 were better. It's a good intervention that works. So let's put this in context, though. The discussion is very well written and very thoughtful, so kudos to the authors. I mean, throughout the trial, I really enjoyed this. I thought it was clearly reported and well done. They mentioned some of the other studies that I've actually talked about at various points in the podcast or newsletters or on Twitters. So one of the funniest ones is the Prairie trial, where they just gave people some Rituxan. And they saw something similar to this, where, you know, it reduced the incidence of arthritis. But again, you know, we're giving people Rituxan, so it's not something I would do anyway. And so I always thought that's kind of a not silly trial, but one that didn't really resonate with me. Now, the Treat Earlier study is interesting. Treat Earlier was similar to this study, except that they're using methotrexate, right? Which is, again, this is the standard of care for rheumatoid arthritis. Methotrexate's dirt cheap. If you're going to talk about moving up our intervention on RA, I think methotrexate would be the first drug that I would reach for. Now, in that study, they didn't see quite the same delay of progression, but they did see the same, hey, treating rheumatoid arthritis with effective DMARDs is effective sort of thing that we saw here, where patients who got methotrexate had improved pain, improved morning stiffness, better quality of life, and MRI findings of synovitis improved. And, you know, later on in their discussion, they talk about what I think is the pivotal difference here, which is that patients in the Treat Earlier study, you know, only 18% of people in that study in the placebo group went on to develop RA, whereas 57% in the placebo group in this study went on to develop RA. And so my overall take for this entire branch of literature is that you are more successful in one of these early intervention studies if you just enroll more patients with rheumatoid arthritis. And so the enrollment criteria for this study kind of selected for patients who, in my opinion, definitely had RA. And that is shown by the fact that 60% of them went on to meet criteria for RA over 18-month period. And, you know, so I think that Treat Earlier, had methotrexate been done on the same population as ARIA, I suspect we would have seen a very similar thing. So bringing this all together, what does this mean for clinical practice? Well, it sounds like I'm kind of being a little critical here, but at the end of the day, I really like this because this in a lot of ways justifies how I think we should be practicing. In this study, we took patients who didn't meet classification criteria for rheumatoid arthritis, okay? And like I just said a minute ago, you know, you don't need to meet classification criteria for rheumatoid arthritis to benefit from immune suppressing therapy. And so, sure, we're taking these people who I think we should be considering treating, and then we're treating them with effective DMARDs, and then we're showing that a lot of them did much better. They felt better. They had synovitis regress. And ultimately, that's my take-home point here, which is that someone who comes to me with a CCP and RF joint pain for more than 6 weeks and MRI or ultrasound evidence of synovitis, I'm going to treat that patient. Now, this is also kind of a bid for doing imaging, because if you're not doing MRIs and ultrasound in patients of this nature, you're not going to find these people, right? You might call them fibromyalgia, and you might miss an opportunity to improve their quality of life. So I think this is also, in addition to telling me that this is a study that sort of justifies my practice of treating earlier, this also, in my opinion, justifies a more aggressive use of imaging. Because if we hadn't done these, you know, these were expert clinicians. These are smart rheumatologists with lots of experience doing physical exams. If they didn't feel rheumatoid arthritis, I'm not going to say that I'm any better than that. So they needed the MRI, and so I think I do too. And so this kind of justifies, in my opinion, doing more imaging for people where, you know, you have some real risk factors like ACPA and RF positivity. Sending that patient away from your clinic without doing imaging if they've had joint pain for a while in a small joint RA-ish distribution, I think is probably not the right course. And then the third thing, and boy, I always like to talk about this. So in this study, 57% of people in the placebo group wound up developing, you know, clinical criteria of rheumatoid arthritis, which very easy to construe that as a bid to treat more. But hey, that also means that 40% of people never actually progressed. And what does that mean? Are these people who would have progressed? Are these people who maybe still benefited some? I mean, if you looked at the MRI stuff, the synovitis even above and beyond, that small group of people improved. But are some of these people over treatment? And at the end of the day, I think some of these people are over treatment. Some of these people had ACPR positivity and RF positivity, or maybe just one of them. And they had just the normal fibromyalgia or the joint pains that accompany, you know, wandering this mortal plane. And so I do wonder, whenever we start trying to intervene earlier, if we're going to be catching more people who don't really benefit from our immune suppressing therapies and are really just only being overtreated. Now, that is sort of a cautionary tale for me when I read this study. And it just tells me that, you know, in a patient who comes in and has high risk of RA, if I do some imaging, I see synovitis, I'm going to offer them therapy. Now, I'm going to offer them methotrexate. So apologies to the ARIA investigators and the pharmaceutical company who ran this trial. I would do a methotrexate. But, you know, I will do that with the understanding that if the patient doesn't respond, I might peel back on therapy, right? Because these patients very well may be ones who didn't need it. And I think you should always be ready to peel back therapies if someone doesn't seem to be responding. I would also be willing to escalate if I really thought that they had rheumatoid arthritis. So not saying that I'm automatically going to peel back if they don't respond right away. I'm going to treat them the way I do with any RA. But just bear in mind that the earlier you treat, the more you're going to be overdiagnosing, the more you're going to be overtreating, and you should just at least keep an open mind towards, you know, revising your opinion and saying, hey, we thought this was rheumatoid arthritis. Maybe it's not actually. So kind of a cautionary tale at the end. Anyways, in conclusion, I thought this was a great study. I enjoyed it. Thanks to the authors for publishing it. I think it helps reaffirm some of the things that I do in my practice. I think a lot of people do. But it also kind of gives us some insight into, you know, potentially being a little more interventional, which may benefit people in the long term. So thanks for tuning in. I hope you all enjoyed this podcast and have a great week.